true. I believe that. What I am is what I am. What I made myself to be is what I made myself to be. I had a high school education and no further, but I know that there's many things I know deep inside of me. I can sit and close my eyes and remember certain Native people that I used to call Nana and Chana and Craig that taught me many, many things. I brought it back when I married my husband and we moved to village life. I brought those things back out of the depth of me in memories that were there. I remembered seeing them, how they sliced their fish, and I remembered how they laid their clams, how they did these things, and I did them from memory. And I was a small child when I left the village, but yet I brought it back out. And I don't think that there's anyone that can't do that. If they want to do that, they can do it. As far as what we're here to testify for is what Angska has done for us or what it hasn't done for us. And like I say, our dreams, each village corporation has its own membership of directors. Those directors have set out a plan. They have told it to their people, and their people have come back and re-elected those directors again because they thought the planning was good. And if you stay with your directors and you handle them as you elected them, your trust is in them, and you keep that trust within them, they're going to do you a good job. But once you start the jealousy and the defacing and the degrading of that person, he becomes less of a man because he's afraid to face you with his face. And there has always been that. I know myself, if I feel my neighbor is talking about me, I feel shut in. All of a sudden, my heart closes, my mind closes, and I don't know how to say hello to that person that day because I think he said something about me. It's really hard, and that is what has happened amongst the Native people, is the fact of mistrust, mistrusting their own brother, their own sister, their own cousin. It's a hard thing, and it's very sad because this has happened, but it happened before, and it can be erased. I don't claim to be a wise old lady or anything else, but I know I've been there a lot of times, and I've seen things change. I feel love very deeply for the sense of people of what they're trying to do. And when I see my neighbor not being able to do what I'm able to do because my corporation has done for me to an extent that I can reach out and do that, then I turn around and I try to help my other family members who have not been as successful with their corporation as we have been with ours. And that's what it's all about, I think, is leaning out and caring enough that you pass it on. Money was not meant to be amongst our people, I don't think, as a rich nation. They can be a rich nation, yes, but what I mean is that I don't think the individual Indian person in Southeast Alaska was ever meant to be a real wealthy person because they don't know how to handle it. I don't, and I think I know a lot, but I still might get a $1,000 check tomorrow and I'll take 900 of it and give it away. And I don't think that's really managing money right, but yet I see that person that needs it, so I do it. But I don't know, I can't testify or say what is right and what is wrong. I do know in olden times of listening to the elders speak and tell their stories, they were always wise because they could tell the story and say what happened and why it happened and what went to the son or what went to the daughter or what went to the cousin or the niece and why those people became what they were was because they were good at that. If a carver was good as a carver, he passed it on to his son. He taught his son how to do it. Maybe he taught his nephew, but that family always stayed carvers. The hunters were hunters. The fishermen were fishermen. The people lived along the coastlines, not because a lot of people say they didn't go into the woods because they were afraid of it, but their food came from the sea, and it came from the coast, right along the coast. The deer, the beaver, everything was close there at one time. As time has gone on and the world has become more populated, everything moves back further. It's just like any place. You're going to get it here in Alaska, too, because your shoreline is now full. People live along the shoreline. They pay a lot of money for the view and for the land. They're getting further into the mountain area and your deer are driven back to the other side if there's nothing on the other side. Once you get to the top of the mountain, you're just going to go down the other side, and if that shoreline is getting built up, you meet it too. So where's your animals going to go? I hear this all the time. What's going to happen? They shift. Evolution takes care of them. I can remember as a little girl, my father used to bring home 7 and 8 deer at a time and throw it on a floor and say, there you are, old lady, cut it up. My mother would have to take care of it. That's the way we were. Now a hunter goes out, he might hunt 3 or 4 days and he brings home 1 deer maybe. Maybe he comes home with nothing. But that isn't because there's no deer out there. That's because of people living there. They have driven them to someplace else, and there's a small amount of them. There's more people than there are animals. More people than there are fish almost now. But I don't know. I've sat here and listened for 3 days now to testimonies here by people, and I think if people will sit back and realize a long time ago, the Indian person sat down because he didn't have the right to vote. He didn't have the right to go to school and be taught in any school. There was an Indian school for him. He had to go there. He was not a citizen of the United States. So in 1927, the Indian people became citizens here in the state of Alaska. They also were able to own land. They were able to vote. They were able to enter a liquor store. They were able to be a person. That happened. We asked for that. That happened. Then we came along and said, we have no land anymore. We haven't got this. So the land fights began. I can remember land fights when I was a little tiny girl because Craig and Klawak were really close, and they were definitely Indian villages. One was a Tlingit village and one was a Haida village. The people signed papers. They took money out of their own pockets, put it in the basket so that a certain person could travel to legislator to fight for, or wherever they had to go, territorial days, whatever it was they had to go attend to, A&B meetings, A&S meetings, whatever it was. They had to have money to go, so people took it from their own pockets so that person could go and represent them. They talked it over before they went. That, I can't say exactly what happened because I was a child, and I don't remember except a few words here and there of memory coming back. Those things did happen. You were signed up on a list because you were an Indian. It didn't matter if you were Aleut or Eskimo or a Tsimshian, a Tlingit or a Haida. If you lived down here, you became a part of them. Their village was your village. You were raised with them. If your mother was not home, somebody else's mother took care of you for that day. That's how it was. Times have changed. We asked for the right to vote. We got that. We asked for the right to own lands. We got that. We fought for this Land Settlement Act, and we got that. We were given 23,040 acres to each village corporation, and the regional corporation also got that amount of land, which was on kind of you being a village corporation. They then got 23,000 acres too, and made the regional corporation larger. Okay, from that amount, then you have your 23,040 acres, you've elected your directors, and they're working on it. You have your land people, this and that, within your directorship of expertism, this comes. You travel to many meetings and you learn many things. You listen and you learn them. You sit down and you work on these things for your corporation, and your corporation becomes successful because of working together. You can't pull apart. There's an old saying, too, that together you stand, divided you fall. That's also another thing that comes into being an Alaskan, is you have to work together. It's not an easy land to live in. You don't get things easy here. But the Indian has got his land now, and years ago, the chief told you, he stood there and he told you what to do. You did it. Now you have your directors rather than their chief, and you're working in the same thing, pattern. You have the same tools to work with, but you have to learn how to make them work. Now it's money. You have your land, and from your land you build your money to buy into other resources that can bring back this. Once you have cut the timber and it's gone, it's going to take 100 years before it can be recut again. Then you take your, when you die, you leave your will to your child, and your child leaves it on, and this is how it's going to take care of the unborn, because it's there. As long as the will is taken care of and you give it to your people, it's going to be there. If you have 5 children, they become less. It has to become less, and we have to fully understand that. But I think the federal government has given us the tool to work with. The mechanism has to come from within ourselves. And that's where we're making a big mistake, is because we keep saying, they didn't give us all we needed. We didn't get this, we didn't get that. We've been given something, and I think we now as Native people have to prove that we can come out of this and handle it. And that's what it's all about. And I think that, God willing, Kavilko has been very lucky. We've been very fortunate in having a great board of directors that are working hard, and we also work with our people, which we're different, I think, in many ways because we're small, and we can work easier together than we can with a big corporation of 15,000 shareholders like SeaAlaska has. I don't see how a board of directors can get amongst those people and decide what to do. It's a running, scattered thing, and everybody has a different idea. Where our corporation is small, and our people are made up of probably approximately two families, and it works good. So I want to thank you very much for this time and for coming here to Ketchikan and giving us this. Whatever it amounts to, we hope that some good will come of it. And thank you, Judge.
Thank you very much.
I think I should say for the record that I had dinner with the board of directors of Kavilko last night, and when I was in Angoon, I spent an afternoon sitting in on a board of directors meeting of the Kuznahu Corporation. All of this enables me to find out more than I would if I were just sitting here listening to testimony, though that, of course, is the backbone of the hearings. Would anyone else like to say anything at this time? Well, I think we'll take a break and reconvene a little later. From Jean Coburn Bailey of Anchorage, Alaska. She says, and she wants this read into the record, "When I think of the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act, I think of Kavilko. And Kavilko has been good for me." I thought this would get your attention. "Kavilko has aided me financially and also helped further my education. I can also see that if Kavilko maintains its continued positive growth, it could also offer a secure future for any children I may have." That's the submission of Jean Coburn Bailey of Anchorage, Alaska. So now we will break and reconvene later. My name is Tom Berger, and this is the Alaska Native Review Commission. We've been holding meetings here in Ketchikan and throughout southeast Alaska now. And we started here in Ketchikan Monday night, and we held meetings yesterday. And then this morning we went out to Saxman and held a meeting there. Then we were back here this afternoon, and now this is our last evening in Ketchikan. So we're open for business, and anyone who has a presentation to make is most welcome to do so now. And if you would just be seated at the microphone next to me here so that what you say can be taken down and constitute part of the permanent record of the proceedings of the commission. I won't say any more than that, because I think all of you know what our job is and why we're here and what we're trying to do. So
before the record begins, I guess I'd like to state that I'll be reading this for purposes of clarity, and the fact that this is a prepared statement by members of the Tsimshian Tribal Association. "Greetings to the elders, the Honorable Thomas Berger, panel, and guest. Welcome to Ketchikan. and thank you for the opportunity to speak on this important matter and for choosing Ketchikan as one of the urban centers to gather testimony. I've noticed a lot of people at these hearings who I haven't seen participate in or normally participate, which I feel is a good indication that, that you're getting a wide representation of opinions here. My name is Richard D. Stone, and I'm the president of the Tsimshian Tribal Association Ketchikan Chapter. I have a bachelor's degree from the University of California at Berkeley in pre-law, and have been trained in business, American history, government, and federal Indian law. I'm currently a high school teacher counselor, and I own an investment firm here in Ketchikan. The statements that I'm about to make are the views of the Tsimshian Tribal Association and do not necessarily reflect my personal views. I want to make this clear. I am presenting this testimony as president of the Tsimshian Tribal Association. I will testify for myself at a later time. The Tsimshian Tribal Association, Incorporated, was organized in Metlakatla and Ketchikan, Alaska in March of 1970 for the purposes of protesting the exclusion of the Tsimshian people living in Alaska from the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. The Senate version of this act originally excluded them under the premise that they were not Aboriginal to Alaska. The association, working through unincorporated committees in Seattle, Sitka, Anchorage, Metlakatla, and Ketchikan, and supported only by member donations, was able to substantiate that the Tsimshian had occupied Alaska prior to the establishment of a geopolitical border between the United States and Canada. The result of this effort was that when the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was passed in December 1971, all of the Tsimshian, approximately 1,100, who were not members of the Metlakatla Indian community, were included as beneficiaries under the act. We are the Tsimshians living in an urban environment, and we do not belong to the village corporations. Hence, our testimony will differ from others since our needs and concerns are different. Before the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was passed, we felt that the Native leadership at the time did not come in contact with the people at the grassroots level. We expected more involvement from the people to ensure a fair representation of the Native population as a whole rather than our leadership's assumptions. The grassroots had no voice in how they wanted to plan in authoring the act. We never expected the extensive corporate structure. We were not prepared for bureaucratic corporations. The Tsimshians have been excluded from a lot of the corporate activity, such as high-level jobs and directors for the board. We do not have a representative on the Sea Alaska Board of Directors. Everything is determined by popular vote, so we do not get represented by our own people. Tsimshians do have special needs and desires. Not always, but there are some. Since funding sources and political appointments for state and local jobs and boards are still largely determined by the leadership of the corporation's recommendations, Tsimshians are excluded from many of these also. Most natives participating in the Land Claim Settlement Act have lost some of their voice. When we go to obtain funding for social programs, we are told to go through our corporations. A good example of this is when the Anchorage Assembly recommended that the Stranded Rural Alaskans Association go to the native corporations rather than the assembly for funding, since a large number of the beneficiaries were of native descent. Are you familiar with that group, AZRA? Okay, they deal with people who have come in largely from villages in other parts of Alaska, and they are very destitute, and AZRA helps them find shelter and food and bare necessities. If I'm not mistaken, the assembly was only considering an appropriation of $100,000 for AZRA at a time when the city of Anchorage was funding some kind of animal shelter or protection agency for about $1 million. Corporations are incorporated under the corporate statutes of the state of Alaska and are not governmental bodies. It is quite a burden and possesses hardships on a for-profit corporation to have to provide for social needs. That is an unfair burden for our directors to have placed on them. It is our understanding that Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was created to benefit all the natives through cash disbursements and by setting up corporations to wisely invest our money so that we will be perpetual and provide for future generations. This has not happened. Our net worth has decreased drastically. Some of the natives in the village corporations have barely received any monetary benefits whatsoever. We have only seen a few native individuals prosper from the act, yet many non-native professionals have reaped the benefits since they were necessary in establishing and maintaining this fairly new and alien idea of managing multi-million dollar corporations. The grab for power and control of the corporations has also caused segregation among the native communities. The misconceived belief that all natives were unjustly made wealthy overnight has created great animosity between the native and the non-native communities. The whole concept of giving equal shares of stock to a group of people is very alien. Unlike a corporation listed on the New York Stock Exchange, where you use your own hard-earned money to buy stock, the natives of Alaska were given their stock. Since they were given their stock, and most of them are not business or corporate minded, it created enormous problems for the boards of directors of the native corporations. Standard Oil does not have to deal too extensively with apathetic shareholders, since it has the benefit of having prudent investors buy into their corporations, people who maintain a strong interest in how their corporation is run. They would never have a threat of not being able to turn out a 50% plus one vote during their annual meetings. Our corporations are set up more like cooperatives, where everybody has equal representation and one person, one vote. In a business sense, you would never set up a cooperative corporation that has the kind of assets that our regional corporations have. If you're a board member of a private or public corporation, you would more than likely maintain a large amount of stock in that corporation. It would be your money that you are investing rather than everyone else's. Also, since our corporations are equally owned, getting on the board is a popularity issue rather than a performance issue. In a business corporation, you either perform or move over for someone else who can, since it is largely your own money at stake. Currently, as shareholders, we have no reasonable means of replacing people. With the newness of business corporations, our corporations rushed into business deals rather than knowing and understanding the markets and a direction for their management teams to take. In the private sector, before you form a corporation, you usually need three elements. One, you need to know what area of business you want to enter and why. Two, you need considerable expertise in that area. And three, you need capital. When our corporations were formed, we only had one of those elements, capital. Many of our corporations were taken advantage of by opportunists. There has been cited examples of blatant corruption and irresponsibility in expending corporate funds. For example, the 13th region that bought $10,000 polar bear rugs for their offices and made no-interest loans, as reported by the Seattle Times. This is what the press is...
The directors or the officers?
The officers, executive officers. These are just two examples I cited. There were others cited in the Seattle Times of abuses by the officers, really extremely extravagant expenditures, and many of those unaccountable expenditures. This is what the press has been able to get a hold of. Just imagine what might have been going on. The passage of the Land Claim Settlement Act has turned Indians into shareholders of corporations and has diminished the clarity of their being tribal members with quasi-sovereign status, or semi-sovereign status, if you prefer. We feel that our directors are faced with an almost impossible task of making our corporation show a profit given the infrastructure and nature of our native corporations. An enormous benefit of forming corporations has been the increased clout in economic and political arenas of the state of Alaska. We have also shown a stronger central voice. Many of our natives have benefited greatly through job and educational opportunities. The act has once again instilled a pride in the land. That's the pride by the people in the land. It has improved the economy of the state of Alaska, which has benefited both its native and non-native citizens. It has improved our understanding of capitalism and the free enterprise system that made this country great. It has given the villages an opportunity to employ their members, which has helped them bring their people back home. And if handled properly, will give us the opportunity to become self-sufficient and provide for ourselves. The Tsimshian Tribal Association not only want to use this opportunity to share the pros and cons of the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act, but would like to make some recommendations for our leadership and possible other indigenous people that might be considering settling in their own countries. Recommendation one, we would like to see that the act directly benefit the masses of the people. Two, that the questions of sovereignty and trust responsibility be resolved. Three, that the Tsimshian Tribal Association get better representation on the Sea Alaska Board of Directors. Four, that you ensure the elders of our tribe see some direct benefits of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act by 1991, and that the question of extending the alienation of stock does not apply to the elders. Five, that if the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act is extended, it only be done at the village level. Six.
Sorry, could you repeat that?
Yes, five, that if the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act is extended through, whether it's rolled into IRAs or extended by Congress, that it only be done at the village level rather than corporate level, regional level. Six, that shareholders have an equal chance to run for the board of directors since the corporations are equally owned by all. Seven, that the Sea Alaska Board of Directors decrease their number of board members. Eight, that since many Sea Alaska shareholders have expressed a great concern for the land, Sea Alaska look into a way to allot shareholders some land, preferably a lottery. Nine, that an extensive effort be made to educate shareholders on corporate and sovereignty issues. 10, that an individual must possess certain prerequisites in order to run for the board of directors, such as A, being a high school graduate or possibly a college graduate, B, being a business owner or having extensive business experience, and C, not having ever been convicted of a felony or crime involving moral turpitude. 11, that the representation of the Sea Alaska Board of Directors be equally distributed according to the populations of the tribes involved.
What would the result of that be between the among the three?
The best I could figure with an 18-member board approximately would be 2 Tsimshian, 2 Haida, and 14 Tlingit representatives. 12.
Excuse me, any idea what it is now?
I think it's like 17 Tlingits and 1 Haida, maybe. I don't know. I might stand corrected on that. I'm thinking of Bob Sanderson as the Haida. Is anyone? Oh, right. Okay, so it'd be 2 Haidas and 16 Tlingits.
Well, no Tsimshians. That's the point.
Right. That's the point. Leesk? Leesk is not on the board of directors. Jenny Leesk?
No,
that's
not on Leesk. Had been.
Oh.
Well, I don't know whether we'll ever run that to earth, but I have the point.
Okay, good. 12, that the types of settlements should either set up some type of government structure with reservation-type power. This is given that some other country may be looking at settling, such as we did. That they either set up some type of government structure with reservation-type power, or it should be a monetary settlement with certain type of stipulations placed on the members' assets for a limited period of time. We feel that the corporate structure is not feasible. In summary, we'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify and hope that information be considered by the management of our corporations and any other people considering a similar type of settlement. At this time, I'd like to answer any questions that you might have, and thank you. Richard D. Stone, President of Tsimshian Tribal Association.
Thank you, Mr. Stone. Could you let me have that written statement? I do have some questions, and thank you. I appreciate your making this presentation on behalf of the Tsimshian Tribal Association. Could you just go back for a minute to what happened in 1971? You said that the Tsimshians were going to be left out altogether on the ground that they weren't Aboriginal peoples. Then you were able to establish that, in fact, there were Tsimshian living in Alaska before the boundary with Canada was finally settled. Mm-hmm. So it was then accepted, I take it, that you were and are Aboriginal peoples of Alaska.
Yes. It was believed that Tsimshians were strictly in Canada, in British Columbia. We were able to ascertain through professional research and anthropological finds and things like that, and we do have people sitting in this room that have a better understanding of that, but we were able to ascertain that we did have settlements and camps within the boundaries of Alaska. And because of that, we were included in the act, but we were opposed quite extensively for a while until we were able to prove that and get that amendment passed.
Yeah. And at the excuse me, at the time of ANCSA, the people of New Metlakatla decided that they would not participate in the settlement. About what percentage of the Tsimshian people of Alaska live in Metlakatla?
That there's some truth in the fact that there are 1,100 off the island people, it would be less than 50%. Metlakatla is regarded as a Tsimshian community, although legally it is a Indian community of a conglomerate of different tribes represented by different tribes. There are Tlingits, Haidas, Aleuts, Eskimos, even some stateside Indians that are members of the Metlakatla Indian community. And it is not a governmental Tsimshian or recognized Tsimshian community per se, such as Navajo might be, representative of Navajos only.
Well, the Tsimshian Tribal Association represents, you say, approximately 1,100 people off the island. Do you claim to represent the Tsimshians on the island?
No, there are, from our figures, there are approximately 1,100 off the island people, Tsimshian people of Tsimshian descent. Now, you know, I'm quite sure that not all of them are aware of us, so I can't say that we really represent all of them.
Yes,
they're not all on our census,
yeah,
if that's what you mean.
Yeah. Well, your Ketchikan chapter, would that be the largest in terms of numbers of people who belong of the chapters of the association?
Conrad?
Yeah, that's the largest chapter.
And when they agreed that back in 1971 that the Tsimshians were Aboriginal peoples of Alaska, did they offer Metlakatla village status under the new act? I assume they must have.
Yeah, the best of my understanding, Metlakatla was offered in exchange for their island that they currently reside on. They were offered participation in the act, which in turn would have been for less land, but also a monetary settlement. Now, the argument was made that this was something that we already had, has nothing to do with ANCSA. It was kind of analogous to Tlingit and Haida settlement, which didn't really affect their being able to get into ANCSA at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that argument was defeated, and they were given the choice that if you opt to stay out of the act, you can maintain your tribal status and maintain the reserve on Annette Island. You can maintain all of Annette Island and receive no monetary and no land benefits. Or you could become members of ANSCA and, from what I've heard, get half of your land back and also a monetary settlement based on the population.
Well, can you tell me what other villages the Simpsons claim should be recognized as villages for purposes of the new act at the time?
Well, I don't know if we could claim a Simpson village per se, but there are definitely large numbers of Simpson in urban areas. I think Ketchikan, for one, should have had a village corporation such as Gold Belt of Juneau and, you know, Shattuck of Sitka and these groups that Simpsons either be part of or maybe two separate, you know, smaller corporations.
Yeah. And in the end, you were made shareholders of Sea Alaska.
That's right.
And so you're simply at-large shareholders of Sea Alaska and hold no other shares.
No village status, unless there are some people who are mixed Simpson and Tlingit or mixed Simpson and Haida or Simpson, Tlingit and Haida that did affiliate with their other bloodline in order to gain, you know, village corporate status.
You said that the question of sovereignty and federal trust responsibility still remains to be resolved, and you said, you suggested, that is, that if the village corporations were rolled into the IRAs, that sort of neat way of summarizing what a lot of people have said at these hearings around the state, but with a view to the land the village corporations hold being put beyond the reach of corporate takeovers and taxation. But you don't suggest that that be done with the regional corporations. They would retain their land and carry on. And that, from your point of view, representing the Simpson people, is the most desirable course. You don't, since your association and its members aren't shareholders in any village corporation, you're really saying that as far as you're concerned, you don't want the regional corporation lands rolled into IRAs or collections of IRAs.
Basically village status, where we once again would probably receive even less input and less representation within those IRAs. And it would be the same people running the IRAs, and we would be excluded from that process, we feel. And we'd be excluded from any kind of monetary benefits. Major consideration also is that if that land were to be rolled into village status, IRA status, our elders would miss out completely on any benefits of the act. And theoretically, our children would be able to gain from that. That's the theory behind that. They have a lot of work to do in that direction and to convince us that would be a feasible move to take in southern southeast. Now, understandably, I could see up north a lot of the different Eskimo villages where they actually lost or traded or got legal title to the land that they physically live on and physically hunt and fish on, and it's a different story. And I think that should be, you know, definitely weighed and taken into consideration that we are different people. Southeastern natives are much different than the interior, much different than the northern and western people and Aleuts, and that each one should be dealt with differently, and that there shouldn't be one big blanket term or big blanket act that will roll all the corporations into village status or all the an extension on all regional and village corporations.
Yes, that's a good point. And you say that if 1991 is postponed, that the elders should have the right, in any event, to sell their shares in 1991 so that they get something out of this. Could I ask a question? Is there, when you say elder, do you have an age cutoff in mind? Is it like old age security or something like that?
I can't answer that on behalf of the association. In my own mind, that's what I think of when I think of in terms of elder. I mean, it certainly isn't anyone 30 and over or, mm-hmm. you know. But that some kind of age limit be stipulated in consideration of that. But the fact that grassroots level people sitting in this room have some say on that, have an opportunity to have input into that, and that we receive, you know, at least fairly objective points of view on both of them rather than one-sided opinions. And
all right, let me ask you another question. And and if you haven't considered this, then don't bother to answer it. But if 1991 were postponed, let us say to 2001, I'm not at all certain that that's a practical thing to do. But mm-hmm. But let us suppose that were done, and the elders were free to sell their shares, would you agree that they could sell their shares to non-natives? Or would their shares have to be sold to natives?
Were you asking my personal point of view?
Sure, give me your personal point of view.
It's a real hard one to answer now. I would have to be convinced between now and then that our corporations are being run effectively, that they are considering the needs of its members, that they are distinct native corporation as opposed to being the same as any other state corporation. And that they are on a path of success. You know, it's hard to say what kind of management could best run those corporations with those kind of assets. I do realize that if that land starts going into non-native hands, the first thing they'll do is replace it with their management and their board, and that we as native people would eventually lose out on all our benefits. But then again, if we maintain it and maintain it ineffectively, we will lose our land base through taxation. The state, the boroughs will tax us, and if we can't make a profit, we're going to have to be paying more and more taxes. We'll start having to lose land, to give up land to pay those taxes, and we could eventually lose it that way also. That's why I say there has to be a lot more details ironed out, and I have to be convinced myself that these things are being worked on and considered, and they are taking reasonable action to amend that situation.
Yeah, during the week, the 2 weeks that the commission has been in Southeast Alaska, every place we've been, people have made proposals to change the structure of Sea Alaska's board. And one proposal has been there be members of the board elected, perhaps two from each village, and so on and so forth. Your proposal would entail people registering with Sea Alaska as Tlingits, Haidas, or Tsimshians. There'd be a separate role, and you'd vote for, in the case of the Tsimshian, two directors on your role, and the Haidas would vote for two, and the Tlingits for 14. I just say that to make sure that we agree that that's how it would have to work.
Mm-hmm. That's what I had in mind.
Yeah.
We have some very capable people of Tsimshian descent with business experience that we feel could be good representatives for us and deal with our specific needs and concerns. We feel the Haidas are in a similar situation, and the Tlingits also have very, you know, I mean, all three tribes have people that are competent and able to do that. But this way, we as Tsimshian tribal would at least be assured some representation and have some say in what the corporation is doing, because a lot of the elections and all that are popularity issues, and you know, individuals have a hard time getting on to the slates and that, because management slates, as most corporations, in fact, I think virtually all corporations generally have a management slate, and they use corporate expenses to perpetuate that management slate. But those corporations are largely owned by those board members. Generally, they may own 5, 10, 15, 50% of the stock to be on that board of directors. Here we have a cooperative type situation where most everybody has 100 shares, some have 150, 200 through inheritance and what have you. But generally, the majority of the people have equal shares in their regional and village corporations.
Well, I think those are all my questions, Mr. Stone. Thank you very much. For a most thought-provoking presentation.
Well, thank you. And I do have another copy for you. This is written to speak from. The other one is a little more grammatically and.
Oh, fine. Let's. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There are other members of the Tsimshian Tribal Association present tonight, I gather. Would any of them like to add anything to what Mr. Stone has said?
Just addressing that 1991, as an elder, eventually, like I was saying, that I think one of the things that the other elders who have passed on, so many of them that we knew that were really looking for this big land claim settlement act, have left us and did not get the real benefit from it. And I think that 1991 is going to be very important, that the older generation that are facing 1991 should get some kind of a benefit. And this is going to be a very difficult thing for the corporations to decide upon. And I think that rather than putting the land into trust state, like they're talking about now, trusteeship, this is going to tie the land up for many years to come. It'll be similar to the trusteeship that you find in the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And if you know anything about regulations on Bureau Affairs land, if the Bureau of Indian Affairs decides they didn't want to sell the timber, it's not sold. And therefore, the people lose out on the economy. So I just really feel that I think we should, as a corporation, that the elder people should really have a lot of input. You know, in other words, it's their money. They were given this money in 1971. And I feel that if the land and the money was given to them, I think they should have a lot to say about it. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, Mr. Stone, please rejoin us.
Thank you once again. That provoked some thought that I had when Mr. Mather mentioned putting land into IRA status. As I said, I was a federal Indian law student, studied federal Indian law quite extensively. We have been losing sovereign power since the Chief Justice Marshall days in the 1830s. At one time, natives governed their land areas and their laws and everything. Slowly, jurisdiction of laws was taken away, jurisdiction of land. We can no longer try non-native people in native courts. We keep losing further powers either through Congress or through test cases in the U.S. Supreme Court. And as Conrad said, we would be having to go through the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which in our mind has been fairly bureaucratic at times. We wouldn't have as much control because there'd be more politics entered into the picture. And also, I'd like the audience to understand that just because you roll land or assets into IRA status does not guarantee that it'll be forever, because Congress is the one that they have plenary authority over all tribes and reservations. There has already been legislation entered into Congress to completely abrogate and terminate all reservations, all hunting and fishing rights, all religious freedom rights. Now, although that didn't gain much support, the fact that it has been put in the form of bills by Congressman Meads of Washington State a while back, Congress does have the final say-so. So we could roll everything into IRA status, trustee type of status. And then maybe by the year 2000, it might be the mood of Congress. They might be getting a lot of pressure from the citizens of the United States, since natives only represent 0.5% of the total population, and they receive a lot of benefits that non-natives don't receive. It may be the mood of Congress to say, let's do away with these reservations, and let's do away with all this tribal status, which in that essence would mean that we would lose those land bases and our ability to tax and our ability to have our own court systems and our own Indian child welfare programs and education programs and everything that we currently enjoy, health benefits and things like that. And I wanted to make that clear, because I haven't heard that or I haven't read that in any of the previous testimony, and I think that's one point that I say when we usually receive one-sided opinions that isn't covered too often. The fact that just because we put it in IRA status doesn't give us a clad guarantee that we will become perpetual and that our children and their children will enjoy those benefits, because Congress can at any time pull the plug and natives would lose all their rights and all their sovereign powers.
Congress did just that in 1885.
The Major Crimes Act, right?
Well, in the Dodds Act. The
1887, it's the Dodds Act.
1887.
Yes, they did that, the Allotment Act.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, Mr. Stone, and I assume you're speaking for yourself in this. So, you said that that if any the Native people in other countries were looking at Alaska as a model, they should. I think the implication was they should reject it, and they should set up some type of government structure with reservation type power, or it should be a monetary settlement with certain type of stipulations placed on the members' assets for a limited period of time. You added, we feel the corporate structure is not feasible. Well, if we were able to turn the clock back, we can't, but just to get the benefit of your views, if we were able to turn the clock back to 1970, how would you do this thing? You say a corporate structure isn't feasible, and you then have these alternatives, a reservation-type government or a monetary settlement mm-hmm. under certain conditions.
The reason that we had laid out those two alternatives, one would be some other countries may have 99% of their indigenous people in village situations, which for that it would be great to set up village IRA type status where they could have local control and determine and control of their assets as well as their governmental powers and their tax powers, the power to police, the power to try, and things like that that go with sovereignty, or like I use a quasi-sovereignty or semi-sovereignty. Annette Island is considered to have sovereign status, but they're not sovereign to the point that they can have a Russian missile base. You know, that would be complete sovereignty. In other words, if they were completely autonomous from the United States. And we wouldn't want that, you know, of course, for obvious reasons, national defense and that, which is why they have limited natives to the semi-sovereign status. The other one would be, and as I mentioned earlier, I do have somewhat of a business background and access to computers and that. And we've done some conservative projections. We were told at the time that Sea Alaska was formated, that all of our, perhaps each 100 shares was worth $25,000. Just, that was a conservative figure. I don't think that was taken into consideration the extensive land base as well as the subsurface, all the minerals that are on the below the surface. Take the $25,000 figure, put it in the bank, say in a certificate of deposit or some kind of high interest yielding account, and we applied the rate of 8%, which is also very conservative, considering that we were just in double-digit inflation for quite a while, an inflationary period, which accounts were yielding a much higher interest rate, and right now we'd be yielding an 8% rate. So if that interest were compounded daily at 8%, that same $25,000 would now be worth $160,000 or $166,000. Not now, but by 1991, which means each shareholder would have $166,000 cash in their account. And that's why I said with some stipulations. The stipulations might be that they cannot withdraw that whole amount until that date, or maybe they can only withdraw the interest off of it, or however they wanted to set it up. But just flat sticking it in the bank would have yielded 160-something thousand. Now, according to Sea Alaska's last annual report, their equity of assets was each shareholder with 100 shares had an equity of approximately 11,700. There again, I'm sure that's not taking into consideration some of these same things that we didn't take into consideration before, such as subsurface rights, things that have not been assayed yet for accounting purposes and tax purposes.
You think 11,000 is conservative?
No, I think 11,000 is what their books show, but that doesn't necessarily represent what they're worth, because you know as well as I do there's a lot you could do with accounting, and of course it's to their benefit not to have assayed subsurface type assets, because they start, you know, without until they're ready to develop them or ready to move into that. And so these we feel were conservative figures, just so we can have in our own mind as a tribal association what some of the alternatives might have been. I'm a precious metals broker. If I had that type of money in 1971, you know, and if I followed it into the same formula that I've been using for my clients, of course that's a very speculative and different type of market, but just to give you an example, it would be 10 times that amount, maybe 20 times that $160,000 amount. And that's just the idea. There are other forms of investments and things. The safest supposedly is sticking it in the bank, but you know, you have to consider inflation and all these other kinds of things that affect the American dollar.
Where were you when they needed you? You must have been at Berkeley studying federal Indian law. By the way, was that Congressman Meads who introduced that legislation? I thought it was Congressman Cunningham.
I think it was Cunningham. Meads wrote it all. Meads was a big friend of the natives, and he helped support the Washington natives in a lot of things until, because of his support, he barely won an election in Washington as a congressman. Because of that, he did a Benedict Arnold. He completely turned face. He completely criticized all the Native programs. In fact, it's in the Senate Select Committee of Indian Affairs report. He was chairman of that committee. And in his concluding report, he completely criticized and reamed the whole process. And then the very next legislative session introduced bills to abrogate and terminate all reservation type status and powers, land holdings, like I said, religious freedom type things that aren't necessarily applicable up here in this area in Southeast anyway, but are definitely a very major concern of natives in the lower 48.
You said that you would, in due course, let us have your own personal views. You can, of course, do that in writing or on some other occasion. Is there anything else representing your own personal views you'd like to add at this time?
Well, hang on one second, and
so happened to jot down a few things.
Personally, now this represents my personal opinion as a Sea Alaska shareholder and a young native in the community. I was fairly disillusioned with the process of hiring and employment, and as I was going to college, I was told by a lot of people, gee, you're doing great, we need you in the corporations, we need your type of people, get the best education you can. I stayed at the best school I could find. I studied hard, got straight A's. I did everything I could with the idea that I would be able to come back and get a good job and be part of the process and just, you know, get involved. And I was told this repeatedly by different people in the upper ranks. And job time came, I applied, I went out of my way to get letters of recommendation and put together a beautiful, eloquent, you know, letter of intent and all that, and to find that the job had been wired and that there really wasn't any intention of hiring anyone other than who had been planned and prearranged type of thing. That basically I was able to substantiate that very well. There are other things that would be more on a speculative nature that probably wouldn't be appropriate for this type of forum. I heard the same thing in Metlakatla too. You know, oh yes, we need you. You get that legal background and you get that business sense and this and that, and we could use you. And I also find myself not too employable there after I got out of school. And I don't know what the reasons are. I can speculate and have good ideas, but you know, I'm not quite sure because I wasn't the one making those decisions. I wanted to mention a personal point of view that ANILCA, which is the amendment to the Alaskan D2, basically, which included made it able for the corporations to buy stock from the people when it does become alienable. In other words, when it is offered for sale, the corporations, if they decide on an individual basis, to my understanding, have first crack at that stock. Now, whether they would have the money or the cash flow to deal with that, I don't know. I also know when I went to college, I had friends they were going to Stanford. Their parents were highly involved in Weyerhaeuser Corporation. And they were telling me that Weyerhaeuser, at that time, had already formed a team of experts to look into possible acquisition of land from Native corporations in Southeast Alaska. This was years ago. I've also heard reports from other people that B.F. Goodrich has done a similar thing, and I imagine other corporations have. In other words, right now, I bet within Weyerhaeuser, they are extremely knowledgeable on the Land Claim Settlement Act. They're probably well-versed on the attitudes of the people, the direction that's taken, and things like that, because they are a timber corporation, and we do possess a lot of prime timber, a lot of virgin timber, and that is really primo timber. They realize that we're in a timber market is in a temporary slump. I think everybody believes they'll bounce out of it and things will get better in the timber industry. Fishing, I don't know. Fishing, I think, will, my own personal opinion, just maintain itself at its current levels. Prices will get better, but the amount of fish and the catches and that will be more and more regulated, but it will be maintained. Unless, of course, they open it up to a lot more people. When they had limited entry, then they cut off the number of people that could fish. A lot of natives got worked out of the fishing picture when they did pass limited entry in the state of Alaska. A lot of natives lost their right to fish that they had previously had. And natives were good fishermen, and many people, many, many Southeast natives made a living. I myself fished for 11 years, and I'm fairly young, but almost all the elderly people I know that were members, say, of Metlakatla, relied on fishing in the fishing industry. I believe Kluwaks lost a lot of boats. Other communities throughout Southeast have lost a lot of boats and a lot of permits to fish. That's really nothing to do with the land claims, but it's just the overall attitude, the fact that we can lose, and we do lose power, and we do lose rights and privileges.